We're going to have to ask, sorry about this delay. Can we shuffle forward a bit? I think we'll have to take the back off. Is it out there? Sorry? A little bit more room. So if you're around the doors, could you just shuffle in a little bit, please? There's a little bit of space there. A little bit of space over there. If we shuffle forward far enough, Dave will be out through there. That's good.
Hello, testing. Hi there, everybody. Nice to see you, and thank you very much for coming here today. And this is the subject of This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours. I don't claim that to be an original turn of phrase to me. What does mission amount to in a pluralist society? Can Christians learn about God from non-Christians? Can we keep a grip on our truth without rubbishing everyone else's? How to be confident without being dogmatic. Okay. Well, I was actually going to bring a photograph with me to Greenback this year to have here, sort of, you know, an enlarged photograph, which I treasure away in the bottom of a drawer somewhere, and I'm really probably quite pleased I did forget to bring it. It's a picture of me in 1971. And I'm preaching in Ripon Market Square in Yorkshire. And I've got kind of Buddy Holly glasses on, and which were quite fashionable at the time, and a suit and tie, and there I am, proclaiming God's word, mainly to pigeons, I have to say.
St. Francis,
right. And every Sunday afternoon, the little church that I was leading at the time went out into the market square in Ripon to preach the gospel to the sinners. And, you know, it was a fairly fruitless exercise, I can tell you. Probably the most notable thing that happened, I recall, was one time when there was a little group, I don't know, there was about half a dozen of us there, you know, and I was determined, I was quite sort of committed at the time to developing my wife's public ministry. Unfortunately, it's never really happened. She was not committed to it at all. And I'd tried to persuade, coerce her into giving her testimony to these pigeons. And she was absolutely adamant that she wasn't going to do it. But, you know, I thought that probably a bit of extra godly pressure might help. So in the middle of this little kind of open-air service we did, I turned to my wife and said, "This is my wife, Pat, and she's now going to come and give her testimony." At which point, she completely disappeared behind the obelisk and away. And that really set a pattern for the rest of our life, I would say, really. I've never been able to coerce her into anything, though she might disagree with that. So anyway, I grabbed the nearest woman, who was someone else's wife, Liz Whiteway by name, who was a little bit more compliant, and she came. And so my wife often says that the pigeons in Ripon Square still believe that Liz Whiteway is my wife. But that was, you know, something that I did quite a lot of at the time, and believed this was what God wanted me to do. It was a good thing to do. And it was all based, I suppose, on a vision of mission. A vision of mission in which the world is basically divided between two types of people. Those who believe in Jesus as their saviour and those who don't. It was all a matter of light and darkness, truth and error, Christians and non-Christians, children of God and children of darkness, lost or found, heaven or hell, you're in or you're out. And that's all there is to it. And I'm sure that's not unfamiliar to some of you here today. And that was, you know, the underlying kind of view of the world that I was working with, that I understood mission to be all about at that particular time. And people of other faiths, well, I don't recall there were a lot of them in Ripon at the time. I'm not sure there's too many of them there now. But they certainly didn't have any part to play in God's purposes. They were part of these others who were out, those who had nothing to do with truth. They had no truth to share with me, and that was all there was to it. I think it was probably well summed up, actually, by a friend of ours called Matt, who went to Bosnia a few years back, when they were trying to sort of reconstruct things there, and there was all sorts of people going and taking, you know, kind of busloads of folk and lorry loads of stuff to go and help rebuild houses and reconstruct the battered society. And they were waiting at the border in a very long queue of people waiting to get through. And in this queue, in all the cars, there were quite a lot of Muslims. And as they were sort of sitting there in the middle of the afternoon at the given time, all these Muslims got out of their cars and went onto the grass verge at the side and set out their little prayer mat and faced Mecca and said their prayers. And Matt said, you know, it was a really quite remarkable and impressive sight to see all these people so committed. You know, they all just sort of got out there and did their thing. And so he turned to one of the Christians that was with him in his party and he said, my God, that is amazing, isn't it? That's really impressive, the commitment of these people that, you know, on the dot, they're out there and doing it. And this guy said, yeah, pity they're all going to hell, isn't it? And, you know, that very much fits into this view of mission that I've been talking about already, one of light and darkness. As I say, you're either in our Christian club or you're out. But can that sort of vision of the world, of humanity, really be true? Does it have any credibility in our eyes in this day and age? Well, it certainly does in quite a lot of people's. Does people's eternal fate, does their standing before God really hinge upon chance issues such as where they were born, what faith they grew up with and they were taught, in the way that I grew up with Christianity and was taught to believe in Jesus? Is it really all hinged on such sort of apparently chance issues as that? Well, I don't think so, and I'm sure you haven't come here expecting me to say any different. But if we can't believe this, what do we do? Is the only alternative to abandon Christianity? Many people have done that for that very reason. They cannot abide the apparent exclusiveness of the Christian faith. And indeed, you know, one might look at other religions and come to the same conclusion too, and just say, as many people have done, religion is basically part of the problem in this world. And there's a lot of support for that particular argument rather than being part of the solution. Well, I want to sort of tell you about a different vision of mission today. And I want to kind of give a couple of sort of underlying foundational points, if you like, upon which we can build this alternative vision of mission. This is a vision which is based on what theologians would call the Missio Dei, the mission of God. God's on a mission. That's good news, isn't it? God's on a mission, and it's his world, and the question is, what is that mission? What is the Missio Dei? I think there's a distinction between mission and missions. Missions are basically the human initiatives and human endeavours, such as preaching in Ripon Market Square or whatever else it may be, considerably more sophisticated these days. But human initiatives which we believe and hope are based on the mission of God, that we are part of this bigger vision and mission that God is on in the world. The Missio Dei, the mission of God, is basically the great divine outreaching to his world, an outreaching to and within the world, I would want to say, human and non-human. So yeah, I'm very happy to identify with St. Francis, because I think that, you know, the other creatures, the other beings that share this world with us, are part of the good news of Christ that lies behind this view of mission. David Bosch, the great South African missiologist who died a few years ago very tragically in a car accident, says this. He says, mission is not primarily an activity of the church, but an attribute of God. Mission is not primarily an activity of the church, but an activity, an attribute of God. God, he says, is a missionary God. But the church, Christian people, are privileged to be able to be caught up with that mission, with that mission of God. And Jürgen Moltmann, the German theologian, says, it is not the church that has a mission of salvation to fulfill in the world. It is the mission of the Son and the Spirit through the Father that includes the church. So the church has an opportunity. It is invited to be caught up with the mission of God, the Missio Dei. And our missions are only authentic insofar as they reflect and are participating in the mission of God, the Missio Dei. There is a mission, which we can share in, because God has moved out of himself toward the world, both in the creating and sustaining of the world, and also in redemption. Okay, so that's my first kind of foundational point, if you like, that mission has to be seen in the context of the Missio Dei, and all of our ventures and projects and missions need to be measured by an understanding of that mission of God. And there are two other kind of theological presuppositions that I'd like to introduce as well. Two distinct Christian spiritualities. They can't entirely be identified as Protestant and Catholic, but they do actually separate out quite often in that sort of way. The first one is what you'd call the dialectical approach. The dialectical approach is associated with people like Karl Barth, the great theologian of the 20th century. And the dialectical approach stresses the distance between God and the world of human beings and the world of human culture. And it stresses the sort of hiddenness, if you like, and the absence of God from human culture. So human culture is basically godless, and God exists and looks upon this world from the outside rather than being in and a part of what's going on. The dialectical approach stresses the sinfulness of human beings and the paradox of the cross and the not yet character of the kingdom of God. So it's very much got a vision for another world, and this world is a world which is within the grip of darkness, of the enemy, and so on and so forth. And that's very much the view of the world that I grew up with in my own Christian upbringing. And it's the basis upon which I preached in Ripper Market Square all those years ago. But there's another approach, which, as I say, is probably more associated with a Catholic spirituality, which is the sacramental approach. And this approach emphasizes the presence of God in the world of nature and indeed of human culture. A God who is self-communicating love. It stresses the creation of human beings in the image of God, an image which, whilst marred through sin, is not destroyed. And so human beings still reflect the image of God and therefore still in some way or other embody and express something of the heart and mind of God. And so one doesn't look at the world of human culture in a black and white sense and sort of say, you know, is it Christian or non-Christian, but rather one expects to encounter God in various ways in the world outside of the church. I don't probably need to stress the fact that my approach falls in line with the second of these. But what does it mean? Well, at a practical level, I think it means that God is in the world, speaking, revealing, inspiring, energizing, acting in and through human beings, not just in the church. And I have to say, from my experience of being a Christian for as long as I can remember and being part of the church subculture all my life, that very often, I have to say, I've encountered much more of that energizing, inspiring presence of God outside of the church than I've found it inside. Sometimes inside can be pretty depressing. It also means that I expect to hear God speaking in a myriad different ways, in a myriad different voices, including, I would want to say, people of other faiths. So listening to God in the many voices of the world is a fundamental starting point, I believe, for all Christian mission. God is the God of the whole world, not just the God of the Christian church. God is present in the world in this revealing, inspiring, energizing way, and therefore I expect to encounter God outside of the church, as well as, hopefully, within. Mission, therefore, to me, revolves much more around the whole idea of dialogue rather than of a didactical kind of preaching a message to. This is the truth, you need to hear it. I've got it, sit and listen. You accept it or you're out. Rather than that kind of approach, mission revolves much more around a dialogical approach. And I think this has been really marvellously kind of conceptualised, really, in the thinking of the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, great Jewish philosopher of the 20th century, who famously wrote a book which separated between two modes of relating, one which he called the I-it mode, and the other is the I-thou mode, two quite different sort of approaches to relating to other people and indeed to the world round about us. And I think that this I-thou, I-it distinction in models of relating offers a great deal of mileage for all sorts of different kind of areas of thinking, but specifically I think it does in the area of mission. The I-it mode of relating is one in which a purpose is imposed upon the other person. There is no real otherness. You know, it is completely a sort of you sit there and listen to what I have to say. So I-it treats people basically as objects rather than as persons, whereas the I-thou model treats people as complete and whole beings in themselves, recognizes the otherness of the person, and respects the integrity of the other person. Now, I have to say that a great deal of Christian mission, and certainly the sort of mission that went on in Ripon Market Square back in 1971, was completely revolving around the I-it mode of relating. A lot of evangelism is basically I-it evangelism. And I can summarize this very well in an illustration. When we first moved to London, we started a little church in South London. And there was a young woman who started to come along to the church. She'd been a Christian for quite a few years and had been in a fair number of churches because she and her husband had moved around with his work. And I got to know Terry, her husband, who was not a believer. I played squash with him a lot. I tried very hard to beat the heck out of him, but mostly failed. And he was just a lovely guy, well, you know, someone I really enjoyed having a drink with and just spending time with. And I used to resolve again and again and again that I would not talk about God, the church, religion, or anything like that with him. And I almost inevitably failed because he had a lovely openness that sort of wanted to listen. He drew me out and he started the conversations. And so, you know, we always seem to get back to that. And one day when Karen and Terry were at our house for dinner, we were just talking about churches that she'd been in. And he said, you know, Dave, I've been in lots of churches with Karen. I've usually gone along to see, you know, where she's going, really. And he said, whenever I go in, he said, you know, I have this realization that people know that I'm not a Christian. And, you know, he said, I can just feel all this kind of love being kind of radiated at me, you know. I'm the object of all this kind of attention and love. I'm the unconverted husband. And they think they're going to be the church that can get me saved. And he said, it's a funny thing, but, you know, he said, in the middle of all this kind of radiated love, he said, actually, inside, I feel quite deeply rejected. Because he said, I know they're not actually remotely interested in me, Terry. He said, they just see me as the unconverted husband, the potential convert, the sort of scalp to be gained. And he said, I know that because as soon as I sort of say something that, you know, abruptly brings the whole process to an end, makes it very clear I'm not even remotely interested, all this attention goes away to some other poor unsuspecting soul. And there you go. That's I-it. And there's a lot of it about. And it's not just evangelism, I think, that can be represented in the I-it model. I think actually quite a lot of the church's so-called social involvement also tends to get caught up into the I-it mode. But you know, that takes us down to the track. The I-thou approach to mission is basically expressed through dialogue. That's how I recognize the thou-ness of the other, is by entering into genuine dialogue. And how does that express itself in practice? The recognition of the otherness of the person, I think, demands dialogue, an encounter in which one is genuinely open to learn as well as to give, to listen as well as to speak. And if I'm not engaged in a conversation, if you will, in which I am open to learn, in fact, I start from the assumption that this person has something to give to me, then it's not real dialogue at all, is it? We're much more sort of moving down the sort of the I-it road. Anne Morrissey, who's one of the speakers here at Greenbelt, wrote in a book called Beyond the Good Samaritan, I think. she says these words: "The assumption at the heart of evangelism is that people will be changed by what Christians tell them or represent to them. It scarcely ever includes the expectation, essential to the process of dialogue, that such transformation or change in outlook will work both ways. The commitment to dialogue means that Christians need to be open to the possibility that their faith and their view of the world will be changed as a result of that dialogue." Now, that's what I'm talking about as I-thou mission, if you will, if you find the word mission helpful. I'm using it in a very sort of broad way here. Someone who really helped me along the road of thinking about this a few years ago was a guy called E. Stanley Jones, who's an American Methodist missionary to India, who wrote a whole flurry of books round about the early 1920s and 30s. And probably the most famous one he wrote is The Christ of the India Road. He's a remarkable man, Stanley Jones, because he went to America very much, I think, with the kind of I-it model of mission. And he very quickly ran out of any kind of faith or belief in this. I think that he felt that the strangeness between his world as an American going there and the world that he was dealing with was so enormous that he didn't feel that he could bridge it, that he had anything really to offer. And he almost had a nervous breakdown and was resolved to go back to America and back to a different life when he had a whole fresh encounter with God. And he said that he met the Christ of the India Road. He met Christ in Asari. And his whole vision of his work in India was transformed. And another one of the little books that he wrote is called The Christ of the Round Table. And you still find it in second-hand bookshops here and there. And it's written in a rather quaint language of the 1920s, but it's well worth reading. And basically, he developed this idea of the round table. And he saw that his mission in being in India was to create a metaphorical round table. That is, a table in which no one was at the head, in which there was genuine dialogue. And so wherever he went, he tried to create a round table to draw together people, Muslims and Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, or people of no faith, and to dialogue together. And the only real rule that they had was that they wouldn't discuss theology. That what they would do was talk about their experience of God, of the divine, and so on, and that from that starting point they'd go forward. Now, I have to say, you know, that he did still have a fair evangelistic sort of zeal about him, and quite a number of people did become Christians through this. But actually, that was by the by to him, because what he was doing was genuinely acknowledging the fact that Muslims and Jews, and did meet some of those too, Hindus, all these people had something to give to him, and he wanted to experience that. He did actually sit at round table with Gandhi on more than one occasion, and you know, had tremendous experiences, he describes in his little book. And I believe that we need today, in our pluralist society, to recover the sense of the round table, to find afresh the whole dialogical approach to our mission as Christians in our world. The whole situation in the UK has changed so radically over the last century. Stephen Toulmin, social commentator, talks about this by saying that there are two approaches that we can have to the future. One of imagination and one of nostalgia. One of facing the future and one of backing into it. And it seems to me that a lot of the church is stuck in the mode of backing into the future, i.e. looking backwards, nostalgically trying to hold on to a world that no longer exists, rather than facing the new challenges and marvellous opportunities that are opening up, I think, for us in the world as it exists today. And in this new situation, the 21st century, I believe that we need to rediscover the whole idea of the round table. And I'm talking about it perhaps from the Stanley Jones end in terms of a relationship with people of the faiths, but it's not just that. I think it's people of no faith in our society. I find, as a parish priest working in North London, encountering people constantly who never go to church, often through funerals and, you know, the usual sort of stuff, but in all sorts of other ways as well, I find that there is enormous openness on the part of people spiritually. I don't feel at all in despair about the state of our society today. I think there's great openness. But I think that the only possibility of relating to that openness is through a dialogical kind of model. rather than one of a didactical proclamation. Walter Brueggemann, the American Old Testament theologian, has said, all claims of reality, he's talking about the postmodern world, all claims of reality are now fully under negotiation, including those of Christian theology. All claims to reality are under negotiation. The whole thing is in a new melting pot. All the old certainties have dissolved and are disappearing away, and a new situation is emerging. Brueggemann says that the church, that theological discourse, is capable of participation in those negotiations. We can be part of the negotiating of our new world, of our new society, provided, he says, we no longer pretend to be privileged insiders, we've got the truth, you need it, or allow ourselves to be trivialized outsiders. What's the point of speaking because nobody's listening? So in other words, there's a kind of new situation. In the past, the church at least lives on the memory of being privileged insiders, you know, in a so-called Christian society. That society no longer exists. We are now in an open marketplace. And increasingly, the privileges of the Christian community, of the Church of England, are dissolving away. And we stand on a level playing field. And I, for one, don't regret that. It's certainly very much how it was for the Christians in the early church, in the New Testament, in the early years of the church. And we're coming back there, I think, today. And we have to, in that new situation, find a fresh way of relating to people that is not falling back on the old certainties, on the old privileged insider kind of mentality. This is my truth. Tell me yours. Is that a statement of relativism? Is it saying that actually no truth really can be seen as being more true than any other truth, or that some things can be deemed as not truth? Is that what it's saying? Well, that's not how I'm personally using it. I stand here today deeply committed to the truth as revealed in Jesus Christ. And I believe the true dialogue is only possible when one remains faithful to one's own faith commitment, if you will. I am certainly very disillusioned with the whole idea of syncretism, you know, of a situation in which basically all truth kind of just gets down into a melting pot and it all goes. To me, that is, apart from anything else, it's the end of any kind of creativity. It's the end of any originality. It is the end of any process of learning. And we need faith communities to nurture our life, both individually and also collectively. So I don't think for 1 minute I'm not going to ask anybody else to abandon their commitment to their faith, and I'm not going to allow myself to do the same. Dialogue is when we bring perhaps extreme differences together in a spirit of openness and love and mutuality with a commitment to learning as well as, very clearly, giving. Let me just give you a couple of examples of how, you know, I see this happening. I think that the voices of postmodernity, I've mentioned this already, but I think there are voices in postmodernity that need to be listened to and heard. Not all of them, but there are voices that need to be listened to. Our known world, Walter Brueggemann says, is under judgment. And he sees postmodernity as basically a judgment on all the old certainties and the elitism that those certainties produced on all sorts of levels, politically, socially, as well as religiously. Richard Rorty, the postmodern writer, says that objectivity is an agreement of everyone in the room. That's what he says objectivity is. People talk about objective truth, but he's saying, what is it? It's basically an agreement of whoever is in the room. And basically what he's saying is that not too many people have been allowed into the discussion. And postmodernity basically is a state that has opened up the discussion. In fact, you know, it's sort of knocked the walls down altogether. And so suddenly you find the people who have been disadvantaged, who have been marginalized in the old modern world, are suddenly finding that they have a voice and that they can be listened to too. And we know that this has been very much the case with the emergence of the voice of women, of gay people, of people of other ethnic backgrounds and people of other faiths and so on and so forth. And so here in this new kind of postmodern situation, I believe we need to go out with an attitude of this is my truth, and I'm confident about sharing that. You know, I'm not apologizing for that, but I do want to know what yours is too. What do you have to say? And let's sort of dialogue together. The voices of spiritual travelers, I've already said, you know, there are people, many people in our world today, in our society, who are on spiritual journeys of one sort or another. You probably know that for quite a few years, in fact, through the whole of the 1990s, I was responsible for a group called Holy Joes, which met in a pub, in fact, in several pubs in South London, and pub crawl, really. And on one occasion there, back in the mid-90s, it must have been, a guy turned up at one Tuesday night at the pub, and he told us that he was a pagan, and that he belonged to a pagan group that also met in a pub in South London called Philosso Forum. And Andrew became a member of Holy Joes. He came to Holy Joes for at least 2 years. He never stopped being a pagan. We didn't particularly try to convert him. We were happy that he came and that he travelled with us for a while. He was a very intelligent guy. He knew the Bible, and I would say probably understood the Bible better than most Christians. And so he actually contributed a great deal to us. He never tried to put his paganism on us. There was a kind of round table, really. And he even asked on a couple of occasions whether he could lead an evening. And, you know, perhaps to begin with a little bit of apprehension, but I did say yes. And he instructed this group of predominantly Christian people about their Christian faith in a very helpful and edifying manner. He definitely had something, a lot of things actually, to tell us. And one day he said, why don't we have a kind of forum between Holy Joes and Philosso Forum? And I thought, oh, Sheba, you know, I have a bad reputation already, you know. Now we're in dialogue with pagans. So with some trepidation, a group of us went to Greenwich to this pub and met this pagan group. And Andrew, who set it up, actually based it on a fantastic model, I think, one I would commend to all of us, really, for real dialogue. He asked me to speak for 8 minutes. Quite an achievement, really. But speak for 8 minutes on what I didn't like about Christianity. And then he spoke for 8 minutes on what he didn't like about paganism. It's a great model for dialogue. And I could have gone on for a lot longer, actually. But I gave my 8 minutes, and the guy who was chairing the meeting, who was a pagan, said, well, I think Dave's given us, all the pagans here tonight, a really big problem, because they've just agreed with everything he said. Of course they would do, wouldn't they? But it was an amazing thing. And Andrew, in fact, part of what he said on that evening was to say that when he was about 10 or 11, I think it must have been, in school holidays, he was riding on a bike in his local woods. He went to Sunday school at the time in a Methodist church, and but he was out in the woods on his bike, and it was a fantastic day, and the sun was just kind of blazing through the woods, and he came to this one little spot, you know, where these beams of sun were coming through, and the birds were singing, and the wild flowers, and it was just, and he had what he describes as his first spiritual experience, you know, an ecstatic sense of oneness with all that was around him. Enthusiastically, he went to his Sunday school teacher and said, you know, that he felt he'd been surrounded by all the spirits of the trees and the birds, and, you know, apoplexy coming on to the Sunday school teacher, who said that this was, you know, the beginning of paganism, which turned out to be true, of course. But it was in no small part due to the way the teacher handled it. Because Andrew said, he said, if the Sunday school teacher had interpreted my experience in the light of divine immanence, the presence of God in creation, he said, I would probably be a Christian today. But there were numerous people there that night who, you know, said that they felt that I had, in what I'd said, given Christianity back to them. They'd grown up in Christian churches and been antagonistic. They'd got hurt or one thing and another. And it was the first of several such dialogues that we had, which were very enriching to us, and I hope and I believe also to them too. I think that, you know, openness to the voice of people of other faiths is very much also a part of this whole dialogue. This is my truth, tell me yours. George Limbeck, American theologian, wrote a seminal book back in the 1980s on the nature of doctrine. It's a book really about a sort of postmodern approach to doctrine and theology. And he encapsulated three models of religion. He talked about the first model as the propositionalist model. That is the model in which truth is one and the same as the doctrine that we hold. So in other words, you know, the things that we believe, that we say about God, all our God talk is truth. No question. That's all there is to it. Doesn't spend much time discussing that, dismisses it. The second model is the one that he grew up with, which is the more liberal model, which basically sort of says that the truth is like a kind of underground river, if you like, and that religions are like sort of wells in which we sort of create a well and dig down into that river. So it's the same basic kind of experience that everybody has interpreted in a different way according to the well that they dig. He also dismisses that because he comes to the conclusion that actually not all religious experience is the same. And in fact, it is detrimental not only to our own but to the experience of other people to try to reduce it all down in that kind of way. And so he talks about a third model, which he calls a cultural linguistic model, in which he's basically saying that religions function rather like languages. And, you know, making the point that has been made before, that you can't have language in general, that you have to commit yourself to speaking a particular language. And so he concludes that, you know, being a Christian for him is his commitment to that particular language about God, if you like, that particular way of talking about God. And I think that perhaps the crunch of that model is to say that one can't kind of merge them all together. You can't have one universal language without losing the individual languages. You have to recognize the distinctiveness of other languages. And, of course, you know, it's possible for you to learn to speak another language, and therefore dialogue is possible. And there's a lot to be said, I think, for that particular model. Karl Rahner, the Catholic thinker, has described the same sort of process, really, by talking about anonymous Christians. So he would say that there are people of other faiths and none who are pursuing God in their own particular way, in the light that they have, if you like, in the form that they have developed in, through the tradition that they have been given. And he believes that you know, they are in effect anonymous Christians. Now, he's been criticized for that because in a way that's a kind of you know, a sort of gathering up of everyone into the Christian fold, rather than recognizing perhaps the otherness of their own faiths. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think what he's saying is that we only have our own particular window on the world, if you like. And therefore, it's a positive thing to look out of the Christian window and say, I can quite happily see these people as being part of this community in the bigger sense that I'm a part of. It's not to, as I say, denigrate the individuality of their own faiths. I think in a way that's a little bit what happened with St. Paul in Acts chapter 17 when he came to the Areopagus at Athens, Mars Hill, where he was waiting for a few of his friends to turn up at Athens and had not much to do, so he wandered around the town, was looking at what was going on, and he came to the sort of this religious quarter, if you like, where there were all these different kind of shrines to different gods. And he, you know, said later that he recognized that they were a very religious people. There were lots of different shrines. And he saw this one that was actually to the unknown God. And when he later spoke to the people of Mars Hill, he was invited to speak to them, he said about this particular one, he said, "The God whom you worship ignorantly, I would like to proclaim to you." And what he did then was to proclaim in the language of Christianity an articulation of what he seems to be saying they already had and experienced, but he was expressing it through the language of the Christian gospel. And it seems to me that, you know, is a very liberating passage, a liberating idea. And it's interesting you follow this with Paul, that when Paul was speaking throughout his journeys in the Acts, whenever he was speaking to Jewish audiences, he always preached from the Hebrew scriptures, what we call the Old Testament. Interesting enough, when he spoke to Gentile audiences, such as at Mars Hill, he never, ever quoted from the Bible. Because that wasn't the sort of language that they understood. That wasn't the sort of world in which they existed. Instead, in that particular passage in Acts 17, he quotes from some of their prophets, their poets, And he talks in the language of the philosophy of their world, of their age, and into that relates, you know, his understanding of the Christian gospel expressed in Christ. So, as I say, that kind of opens up all kinds of possibilities, and I certainly see it as the basis for a dialogue that goes beyond the kind of confines of what happened there in that historical situation with Paul, opens up the necessity of us working in dialogue, sitting at round table, being open to learn, and so on and so forth. So listening to God through these many voices, tell me your truth, this is mine, I think doesn't at all imply or necessitate a betrayal of one's own faith. It just means a recognition of the limitations of one's own faith. And I would say, you know, quite boldly that I think that God is bigger than Christianity. And that God works beyond the boundaries of Christianity. And I am a Christian. That's what I'm committed to. That's what I will argue for and persuade people about, I hope, till the day I die. But I worship a God who I think is bigger than the faith that I have, that I hold, as I understand it. Because I only have a very limited human grasp of that anyway. Hans Küng, another Catholic theologian, who is very committed to the whole idea of dialogue between different faiths. Indeed, he started a whole thing called the global ethic, based on the notion that there can be no peace without peace among the religions of the world. He has been a contributor to something called the Parliament of Religions, a kind of meeting point of people of other faiths who aren't trying to convert each other, but who are saying, we all share a concern for this world, and let us try and find the sort of common areas in which we can work together to bring peace and justice and so on and so forth into our world. And Kung offers, I think, three very helpful thoughts as we try to listen to and dialogue with people of other faiths and other voices of no faith as well. These are the three things. He says, no indifferentism, for which everything is of equal value. So he's not advocating an indifferentism which basically says everything that is said is of equal value. In other words, this is my truth, tell me yours, is basically saying it's all the same and there can't be any criteria at all by which you can measure or judge the kind of worth or value of other voices. So no indifferentism for which everything is of equal value, but more indifference over the kind of absolutism that makes itself the criterion for human salvation or damnation and seeks to impose its claim to truth by means of power and compulsion. So that's his first point. His second one, he says, no relativism for which there is no absolute. In other words, saying, you know, that there is no reference point beyond our words, our language, our human concepts, and so on and so forth. No relativism for which there is no absolute, but more relativity in all that human beings make absolute and that prevents a productive coexistence of the various religions. And then thirdly, no syncretism where everything possible and impossible is mixed together and fused, but more will for synthesis, for slow growing together in the face of religious conflict and hatred, which costs blood and tears every day, so that peace can prevail between the faith communities instead of war and strife. Well, I take on board those three points of Kung, that I'm not advocating the kind of indifferentism that just says everything that's said has equal value. I don't believe that. I don't believe in a relativism that has no absolute reference point at all. I do believe that there is a God who exists outside and beyond all the things that human beings say that they believe about God. And also no syncretism in which everything is just kind of mushed together and, you know, we end up with no distinctiveness at all. We can only properly listen to God in all these many voices if we are rooted, I think, in a critical commitment to the voice and revelation of God in our own faith tradition. Now, Paul says, we see through a glass darkly. That literally means what we now see is a riddle. The word actually from the translation of the Greek is enigma, What we see now is an enigma, a poem, a riddle, not something which is absolute, final, and ultimately packaged, but something which is a paradox. And let me finish by saying this, that often we recognize the truth, I think, better in pictures and images and stories than in dogmatic statements or creeds, which are usually the things that separate us and divide us, aren't they? And so I finish with a short piece from C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle. If you've read it, well, you may know that in the last days of Narnia, after the last battle had been fought, we're introduced to Emeth, the young Carlemine prince. Emeth hated the name of Aslan, the true ruler of Narnia, who was a lion, and worshipped the false god Tash. In the afterlife, Emeth entered the heavenly stable, expecting to meet Tash. Instead, he found himself in the kingdom of Aslan, and he was greeted not by Tash, but by the great lion himself. And Emeth relates what happened. The glorious one bent down his golden head and touched my forehead with his tongue and said, "Son, thou art welcome." But I said, "Alas, Lord, I am no son of thine, but the servant of Tash." He answered, "Child, all the service thou hast done to Tash, I account as service done to me. No service which is vile can be done to me, and none which is not vile can be done to him. Therefore, if anyone swear by Tash and keep his oath for the oath's sake, it is by me that he has truly sworn, though he know it not, and it is I who reward him. And then if anyone does a cruelty in my name, then though he says the name Aslan, it is Tash whom he serves, and by Tash his deed is accepted." But I said, "I have been seeking Tash all my days." "Beloved," said the glorious one, "unless thy desire had been for me, thou wouldst not have sought so long and so truly, for all find what they truly seek." So I believe that we should listen carefully to the voices of other people, of other voices in our world, because we're human and our vision is limited, our knowledge is partial, because now we do see in a glass darkly. Now we have a paradox, because whilst there's much divine truth to be sought and found, there are no human certainties. That's the way I see it.
Thank you, Dave. He's going to take some questions. Now, we have one microphone and a large number of people. So if you've heard of body surfing, we're going to do some mic surfing now. So if you can stick your hands up, I'll send this across and we'll require you to all contribute to getting it to its destination. So that gentleman over there.
Thank you very much for a great talk. I went to school in Bradford. And in my class, there were Sikhs and Muslims, every faith. I think I was probably the only white person at the end. I say Christian at the end. I didn't have a problem at all with living or working with other faiths. Until I went to an evangelical church, where I was made to feel suddenly Muslims were the enemy. And there was a lot of preaching around the statement when Jesus says, "I am the way, no one comes to the Father except through me." And I have real trouble with this because I can't square it in my mind. I'm not trying to convert people. I want to know people. I want to love people and share my faith with them. But am I always to look at them and thinking, it's all in vain because you are going to hell? Or am I to look at them and say, to what purpose is this dialogue? Well, you've spoken about dialogue, but to what purpose?
Jesus did say, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." He also said, "Other sheep I have who are not of this fold, those also I must bring." And that, probably related to the Gentiles, But I think it's a very expansive kind of statement. So you have to sort of, you know, take one against the other. Also, I think that within the scope of what I've been saying, I think speaking as a Christian, believing that Jesus is the way to God, I can quite happily live with the fact that people come through Jesus without necessarily knowing that name Jesus. You know, so you know, a rose by any other name smells just as sweet, they say. I think that people can, I think that Paul gives us a helpful differentiation between what you might call the historical Jesus, the earthly Jesus, and the cosmic Christ. Jesus was the human incarnation and manifestation of the cosmic Christ of God. Christ clearly was bigger than the human being Jesus of Nazareth. And so I think that, you know, Christ thought of on that level can serve as the means of finding God without people necessarily knowing or understanding all the details of the historical Jesus.
Would be nice if we switched on. Yeah. All right. I'd just like to make a comment first about what you're saying about dialogue and everything. I'm not a CV, but obviously one of the things that seems to get in the news with the CV is the kind of whole thing of interfaith and people meeting together, you know, and even like Diana's funeral and stuff, you have people of other faiths, and I think a lot of people are pulling their hair out or whatever, evangelicals and that. Do you think a lot of that is the outworking of what you're going on about now? And is there anything to be scared in the midst of that? Because I certainly am not totally at ease with that. There might be a lot of ignorance in that as well. I accept that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is we do live in a pluralist society. And, you know, we can't live with this nostalgia for something in the past in which the Church of England, you know, the Christian sort of community in the established sort of sense in this country sort of was the be-all and end-all. That's just not the way it is anymore. It's interesting, actually, in a report by the Church of England's Mission Theological Advisory Group recently commented on this very... So it made this comment, which I think is worth me repeating. We do not live, it says, in a godless or totally secularised society. We live in a pluralist society in which most of the world's faiths are represented. Also, many people outside formal religion feel that their life has been touched by the transcendent and seek to respond to this. And it goes on to conclude that Christianity should not have to ride roughshod over expressions of contemporary spirituality, for there is a capacity for a dynamic and interactive relationship between the two. And I really do believe that. I think that when you've come from the security of what, you know, I suppose I would think of as being the kind of ghetto society of the church, you're bound to feel uncomfortable, you're bound to feel threatened when you come into contact with a world that seems in many ways quite threatening to your little world. But I believe that, you know, these are days for confidence and boldness. I'm not advocating going out and abandoning one's own Christian faith. I'm advocating going out and standing for that critically and openly and compassionately in a dialogue with people of other faiths, recognizing that, you know, they are on authentic journeys of their own, which are different journeys to mine. And it's interesting, I wish I could put myself right to it, but there's a lovely little shaft of light about this in the book of Micah, in which God is speaking through Micah and saying to the Israelites, I brought you up out of Egypt, but I also brought the Egyptians, da-da-da-da, and there are sort of, you know, two or three different kind of peoples mentioned, which kind of just opens the thought that there perhaps are other narratives. You know, I inhabit the Christian narrative, and from within that narrative, I can't get a vantage point to look out objectively on the whole lot and sort of say, this is how it is. I can only ever look through this window. I can only ever speak out of this narrative to which I'm committed, and I'm not apologising for that. But I have to be, I think, agnostic about what is happening amongst other peoples coming on other journeys with other narratives. And that's what I mean when I say I think that God, like God was saying in that passage that he was bigger than the Israelites, I think that God is bigger than Christianity.
Hi. You talk about the model of religions as languages for talking about God, and you quite rightly say that there can't be a universal language. Do you think it's possible at least to be bilingual? Can you, for instance, be a Christian Buddhist, Christian Hindu, something like that?
Well, I certainly think it's possible to be bilingual in the sense of speaking the language. I mean, I think that I can... I'm not very good at language, I have to say, but, you know, my wife speaks French, and she can't speak French as a French person, you know what I mean? She's it's not her native language. I think that there have been all sorts of interesting and, I think, very stimulating experiments in merging together. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff about sort of Christianity and Zen, for instance. Someone like Scott Peck, the sort of popular kind of psychology writer, was a Zen Buddhist before he was a Christian. Then he had a Christian conversion, and he says that he found his Christianity was completely compatible with Zen, and so he was happy to sort of walk with them together. So I think that probably, you know, there is the possibility of a sympathetic kind of interchange and an empathy. I don't know that you can actually sort of, to completely mix the metaphor, ride two horses at the same time. I don't know. That's not something that I experience or that I can comment a great deal on, really. But I do think that there are thoughts and ideas and experiences from other faiths which I find I don't have any easy Christian equivalent to. And therefore, I can quite happily sort of, rather like the way in which, obviously, languages, the English language remains the English language, but it has taken on words from other languages, hasn't it? And so it becomes a rich kind of mixture from elsewhere. But it doesn't lose its essential character. It doesn't, you know, become a sort of mixture of the two in the sense of losing its own kind of integrity. And I think that's what I would want to defend, really, the integrity not only of my faith, but of people of the faith too.
To what extent, Dave, is your commitment to Christ provisional? And if it's not provisional, can you still genuinely dialogue? Perhaps from the other point of view, when you enter into dialogue, is it your hope that the other person will convert to Christ? And if so, is that hope stated? And again, if that hope is stated from the outset, does that hinder dialogue or not?
Well, that's a very good little set of questions, isn't it? which means better than the answer. Is my commitment to Christ provisional? I kind of think ultimately it has to be, in the sense that I think that I, you know, if I have a genuine openness of spirit, then I think I have to say that if I could be convinced that there was a revelation of God that was greater and more clear and more persuasive and more challenging than the one that I have received in Christ, then I have to be open to it. I think not to do that would be to put yourself in a kind of end of a journey sort of situation. I don't expect that to happen, you know. I'm not kind of living with a provisionality of spirit. I think, you know, I'm very committed to Christ and the gospel as revealed in Christ. But I think, you know, to say, you know, this is a no-go area, I won't have that conversation or entertain that possibility, it would seem to me would be to the end of the human spiritual quest, if you like. In my dialogue and with people of other faiths and none, am I hoping to convert them to Christianity? You know, I think that I am hoping to persuade them about the integrity and the persuasiveness of Christianity as I know it and experience it. I'm not necessarily going out, you know, sort of wanting to proselytize people. You know, I think that, you know, I accept the fact that there can be an authentic pursuing of God outside of the narrative that I know and I experience. Therefore, I don't think it's a kind of heaven and hell type of issue. But at the same time, you know, I'm very enthusiastic about Christianity, and therefore, in an open marketplace, which I think is what we now have, I want to be able to, like St. Paul in his day, argue enthusiastically and persuasively for the Christian faith as I believe it, but as I say, not thinking that if people don't see that, or they're going another way, that means that I have to consider them as the lost, the outsiders, the no-hopers. You know, I can believe that God's heart and will encompasses beyond the borders that I myself live in.
I'll ask questions over there.
Okay.
You mentioned these three models of the propositional model, expressivist, and cultural linguistic. And certainly I don't want to go back to a purely propositionalist model where word isn't made flesh anymore, it just stays as text. But is there an element of the propositional, can you merge that a bit with the cultural linguistic? Because it seems to me if you've just got narrative and then another narrative, you can't actually get dialogue because people are speaking in different worlds and you haven't got a rationality that can break free of the worldview that you're in.
Yes, well, I think that probably puts a finger on my reservation about Lindbeck's cultural linguistic one. I like it a lot. I find it very helpful. I do have reservations about it, and I think one of them is, and this has proven to be true in practice of people who espouse it, that it can lead to its own kind of conservatism. Because basically you kind of say, this is my language, if you like, this is my world, and therefore, you become quite conservative about kind of preserving it without sort of influences from elsewhere. And I do find that, quite a sort of challenging area, really, in that model. So I suppose that you can merge the two. I'm not sure that's a helpful thing to do. It's not the way I personally wish to go, but I think that you can. And it's interesting that, in fact, particularly in America, there are quite a lot of evangelical Christians and theologians who find an empathy with Lindbeck's position, even though he's actually coming from a liberal background. So it kind of shows the fact that I think that people who are looking for something more conservative do feel that perhaps that offers a way of doing so, of sort of saying, okay, there are other sort of language systems, we don't have to bother about those, we just have to be committed to this one and preserve this one. And I think insofar as that or any other model promotes a kind of elitist, exclusive kind of outlook, I'm unhappy with it, because I really do feel very committed to the kind of I-thou sort of model of dialogue and exchange in which I'm not sacrificing or abandoning my own commitment, but I can gain from and learn from and draw on the strength and insight of people coming from a different direction to my own.